My featured musical this evening is a 60th anniversary tribute to Stop the World, I Want to Get Off, which had book, music and lyrics by Leslie Bricus and Anthony Newley. It opened at the Queen's Theatre in London on the 20th of July 1961, where it ran for over a year. And we shall be listening to the original 1961 London cast recording. But to introduce the musical, it's my very great pleasure to welcome back to the program via telephone from the south of France, the Academy, Grammy and Ivor Novello award-winning composer, lyricist, librettist, screenwriter and nonagenarian, Leslie Bricus. Hello, Leslie.
Hello, Rob. I can't believe it's 60 years, but it is. It's frightening how quickly the time has gone.
Yes, and I guess it almost seems just like yesterday.
It absolutely does, because so many wonderful things happened during that period of time, first in London and then on Broadway, that it was very memorable and one of the highlights of our lives, obviously.
Mm-hmm. And I believe the show began when Bernard Delfont approached Anthony Newley with the idea of doing a show in London. And at that stage, you weren't quite sure what the show was going to be. But when did you first meet up with Anthony Newley?
I was coming back from Australia. Evie and I have been married 62 years. So our honeymoon was around the world honeymoon. And we were coming back from Australia on a P&O liner, and I heard this voice that I recognized singing a song on the boat, and I said to Evie, that's Tony Newley. I'm going to contact him when I get back to London. Mm-hmm. And I found him in a recording studio in London. I also found the man who became our musical director for 60 years, Ian Fraser. Mm-hmm. And the three of us together went through a long period of all sorts of adventures together. Then what happened was Bernard Delfont called Newley and offered him 2 weeks in a theatre in Brighton. And if the show worked, they would bring it into London. But Evie and I were about to go to New York when Tony called us about this project. And I said, I'm so sorry, mate, but we've promised Auntie B, Beatrice Lilly, who was a wonderful comedian, huge star in the Noel Coward era, mm-hmm. and she was like a fairy godmother to me. She was wonderful. Anyway, I said we can't do it. We're off in the morning, so I hung up rather reluctantly, and Evie said that was a mistake. Call him back and tell him to come with us. I said, he won't come with us all the way to New York. He said, call him back. So I called him back, and he came with us to New York. Mm-hmm. And Auntie B, as we called her, gave us an extra apartment that she had on the East River. And we had 14 days in which I was working with B in the morning every day, and I started at noon with Newley. Mm-hmm. And we had no idea what we were going to write. And in 14 days, we had never written a song at all. It was the first time we wrote a song. And we wrote the book in 8 days. And we wrote 14 songs in 6 days, which included the following year's Grammy winner, What Kind of Fool Am I, Gonna Build a Mountain, and Once in a Lifetime. So someone was smiling at us, and we never changed one word. Mm-hmm. And we found the title, Stop the World, I Want to Get Off, which was appropriate to the piece, because it meant Tony could break the fourth wall and come and comment on what was happening on the stage, which was a wonderful device.
Yes. And he also directed it, and I note, instead of a choreography, the original credit was a mime by John Broome. So I guess that took the place of choreography.
Well, it was not so much dancing as movement. Mm-hmm. Newly created a sort of, what was the great French mime artist?
Oh, Marcel Marceau.
Yes, he developed a lot of that, a combination of things which he did brilliantly, and he also directed the show, and I think in those following weeks, because he went back to London and left us in New York. And by the time we sailed back with Auntie B to London, he was halfway through rehearsals. And what he did in those few weeks as a performer, as a writer, and as a director were quite extraordinary achievement on his part. And yet he didn't win any awards, because it was the same year as Oliver, and Oliver kept beating us for the awards, and Ron Moody kept beating Newley in the individual star. Mm-hmm. But Anna Quayle, who was our leading lady, did win a Tony Award on Broadway.
Yes, and she
we got nominated, but we didn't win anything.
Quite disappointing at the time, but I guess for a first-time musical together, it was quite an honour too to receive such nominations, at least.
Oh yes, and it ran longer on Broadway than it did in London. So we were very happy with the result.
Yes, I noticed, according to the Internet Broadway database, it was a round figure of 555 performances, which seems quite incredible.
It was amazing because Bernard Delfont mounted the whole thing for £3,000 in London. Mm-hmm. £3,000 to put on a musical. And of course, what we didn't realize, how clever we had been, because there were no costume changes. There was only one set. So it was immensely economical to produce. And that's been a factor in its success ever since.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. And Anthony Newley, the sole male in the cast, and 10 females opposite him, including Anna and the rest of sort of...
Well, that was his original intention when the first idea for Brighton came up. Newley said it'll be a one-man show with 10 birds in it, and it was.
And I noticed just prior to London it had a tryout season at the Palace Theatre in Manchester on the 20th of June. How was the critical reaction there, and did it sort of give you a sense of what you might face in London?
No, we were lucky all the way with Stop the World because of Tony's performance. He was irresistibly funny and charming and naughty and attractive. It was a star performance and maybe the best thing he ever did.
Mm-hmm. And a tour de force too for Anna Quayle, who played all the women in his life, including Evie, who I believe was inspired by your own wife.
That's right. We called her Evie as a tribute to Evie, because Evie, my Evie, looked after us during the 2 weeks we were writing it. And so we didn't have any disturbances, and she was wonderful then as she is today.
Mm-hmm, indeed. And I noticed that the American girl that he meets, her name was Ginny Romaine, which I guess was also a nod to Evie as well.
Yes, indeed. That's right.
Where did the concept of having the one actress play the multiple women in his life and of different nationalities come from?
Newley? Well, what we did was we had Evie play four different women, an American, a German, a Russian, and an English woman. There was a song called Typically English, which we converted into Typischer Deutscher, and the All-American Girl. So they were prototypes of a woman in each country. And of course, we still had the memories of the war back then, mm-hmm. So we were able to take some anti-German digs, and we were able to have a few Russian digs as well, and of course American. So it was quite strong satirically.
Mm-hmm. And did Anna Quayle audition for the role, or was it the role written with her in mind?
She auditioned, and she was such an odd creature. She was an enormously big, tall lady, mm-hmm. and a wonderful comedian. We used her two or three times, or I did, in later shows, because she was such a wonderful comedian. I used her in Henry VIII musical. She played one of the queens of Henry, mm-hmm. and she was always instinctively very funny. She couldn't not be funny.
Yes, yes. And of course, many of the songs in the score of Stop the World were extractable, and it notes on the CD cover about some of the cover versions, including Beatrice Lilly doing Typically English, Lonnie Donegan did Lumbered, the Chris Barber Jazzmen, Matt Munro, Edie Gourmet, Vincent Edwards did Gonna Build a Mountain, the Countrymen, incredibly, did Malinky Milchik, Dolores Gray, Keely Smith, Jimmy Justice did Once in a Lifetime, Kathy Kay and Billy Cotton did Someone Nice Like You, Count Basie, Buddy Greco, Brenda Lee, Shirley Bassey, Vic Damone, Frankie Lane, Carmen McRae, Andy Williams, The Letterman, and Sammy Davis Jr. did What Kind of Fool Am I? And of course, Sammy did it with Gonna Build a Mountain and achieved his first million-selling single through that particular recording.
Well, Sammy was the first person. We met Sammy in London at that time. He was due to open at the Prince of Wales Theatre a week after we opened at the Queen's Theatre. And he came to see us on the Monday night and the Tuesday night and the Wednesday night and the Thursday night. He came every night to see the show. And we all had dinner together afterwards. And that was the beginning of a great, amazing friendship, but that was also very productive artistically. Sammy recorded over 60 of my songs in his lifetime, and the first four of them was Stop the World. He did what was called an EP, extended play, a little baby LP, at that time, and that was the first thing to be released in the United States, and that was hugely important because it started 1,000 recordings of What Kind of Fool Am I?
Incredible.
1,000.
Yes. Indeed. Yeah. And the royalties keep on coming.
And we won the Grammy Award for Best Song of the Year. Mm-hmm. It was amazing.
Indeed, yes. And the Ivor Novello Award too. Was that your first Ivor Novello, or had you won one before that time?
I don't know. I forget whether it was first or second. I got three that year because we won for Best Song, Best Score, and I won another one for Most Performed Song, a little thing called My Kind of Girl that Matt Monro made a hit. So I had three that year.
Indeed. The hat trick, as they say in cricket, I guess.
Indeed, indeed.
And, of course, Sammy did a limited run of Stop the World back in 1978.
Well, he played Stop the World. He waited a long time because Sammy's life was very expensive to run. And in the theatre, he couldn't break even though they paid him top dollar. And we opened the show in L.A., in Los Angeles, at the Schubert Theatre there. And then he moved on to Chicago. And the theatre manager said at the Schubert, we could have played a year here if you'd wanted, and you could have lived at home. And that was a bit, very frustrating thought for all of us because we all lived close by. In fact, Sammy bought Newley's house when he and Joan divorced. Mm-hmm. So Tony and Joan had bought it from Tony Curtis and Janet Lee. And then the Newleys divorced, and it became Sammy's. So we knew it as Heartbreak Hotel.
Indeed. quite appropriate, indeed. Yes, I guess the nightclub scene was and the cabaret scene in Las Vegas was a bit more lucrative than eight shows per week doing the same thing for Sammy, perhaps.
Well, the kind of money they were paying, it was ridiculous. I mean, Newley, when he went to Vegas, was earning over $100,000 a week, which is more than the theatre would gross. Mm-hmm. So you can't get that kind of money in the legitimate theatre. You have to make it in Vegas. So Sammy was part of the Sinatra Group, Dean Martin and that lot. And Newley did very well in Vegas. In fact, he was the performer of the year in 1973. He won the award, beating Sinatra, Sammy, and Dean Martin. Mm-hmm. So they were all pretty successful.
Indeed, yes.
But it ruined Newley's career, strangely enough. He played the Vegas circuit for a decade, 10 years, 1970 to 1980. And what happened to him during that time was he lost his film career, he lost his recording career, he lost his stage career, and he lost all the wonderful things that I described he did in Stop the World. So in fact, it was a tragic time, not a good time. And Las Vegas is, you know, it might as well be on the moon, it's another planet.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of the decade, he had nowhere to go. That's the tragedy.
Yes.
But when he came back to England, I put him in Scrooge, playing Ebenezer Scrooge, in my stage musical, and he played that 5 years before he left us.
Mm.
And he was wonderful in Scrooge.
I note, too, that he also appeared in a revival of Stop the World back in 1989 with Australian performer Rhonda Birchmore.
Really? I did not know that. Yes, we were always sad because when Joan Collins was married to Tony Newley, we were known as the Fab Four.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a wonderful time. And we were talking about it with Joan the day before yesterday. We had lunch with her the day before yesterday. We're still very close, Evie particularly, with Joanie. And I've always thought that was a good time in her life. She had the two children, Tara and Sasha.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very happy for a while, but it didn't last. Tony was too keen to look around at other women, which was stupid, given that Joan is one of the most beautiful women on earth.
Yes, I suppose almost mirroring the Stop the World, I Want to Get Off plot itself in some
absolutely
some way, almost prescient.
Well, what ended up happening, Newley played in real life the role he played in Stop the World.
Yes.
Because he was always picking up different birds, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There we are.
Indeed. And was there any thought about revising Stop the World, I Want to Get Off to bring it up to date to the current?
Various people have approached us to do it, but, you know, it was of its time.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided to leave it alone and let it die gradually. And it was not for now, because you'd have to change the nationalities of the women, and what would you change them to? So it was better to leave it alone and just let it have been a success when it was born.
Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, as you said, Tony didn't get to make the film version, but there was a film version with the takeover artists, Tony Tanner and Millicent Martin.
Well, the reason Tony didn't do the film, Arthur Jacobs, who was a film producer, I went on from Stop the World to do Dr. Dolittle for him at 20th Century Fox as a movie. And he was asked if he would make the film in 8 weeks during the show, which was impossible because it was a very, very demanding role. He was on the stage the whole time,
mm-hmm.
you know, 2 hours. And to do the film for 8 weeks, filming all day and then the show 8 times a week, was just not physically possible. So he let some other character do it. I forget who it was. Tony Tanner, I think it was.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it was all right, but it wasn't anything special. It was made in a bizarre process called electronovision,
mm-hmm.
which they were all experimenting with different types of film. But it wasn't terribly good. Millicent Martin was good in it. She played the Anna Quayle parts.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose with the technology development, a few years later, they could have actually filmed it live in the theatre during an actual performance, as some of the current shows
yes.
being done. Mm.
They probably could, but that was before the time of those things. So it wasn't not to be, but we were very happy with what we had, so that was fine.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. And, well, with the current world situation, of course, the theatre has very much taken a back seat, although I believe the West End is to open up in the British autumn time. Is that the latest word?
Well, I think it's opened up a bit too soon. This thing isn't over yet. And Andrew Lloyd Webber, bless his heart, is doing everything to get it going again. And he was quite right to try what he did. And I don't know what the situation is, because they have an audience there with no masks on, or it's not demanded. And we'll see what happens. It's a musical called Cinderella at the Gillian Lynn Theatre.
Okay. Is that his own version or the Rodgers and Hammerstein version? Or
no, this is a new version of Cinderella, very updated. And the book of it was written by Emerald Fennell, who won the Oscar for Best Screenplay for Promising Young Woman in March. So she's having a dynamic year.
And I guess many of your projects had to go on hold too.
Well, you know, Cameron McIntosh, who's got half a dozen musicals in London, you know, Les Mis, Mary Poppins, and all sorts of things. And obviously he's desperate, as indeed he should be, because they've taken enormous losses in the last year. And I don't know what will happen, because there's a current sharp rise in cases with COVID in England, and I don't know what will happen. I wish them well, and I hope it all works itself out. But I think it, in some ways, although it's very expensive, it will. But again, theatre owners think differently than the rest of us. I think we'll have to wait till next year. I'm waiting till next year with what I'm doing next.
Yes.
We'll see what happens. I mean, we'll pray that all goes well and that the shows can open. But I think it's a gamble at the moment with the rising cases in London, because the numbers are have really shot up. 30,000 yesterday.
Yes, quite extraordinary. Times that we're living in, I guess, ironic that 60 years ago you coined the phrase, stop the world, I want to get off, and there are a lot of people these days who are thinking the same thing.
Yeah, now we really do, don't we?
Yes.
Want to get off.
Oh, that reminds me, I seem to recall you telling me that you'd written a title song too for the musical.
Yes, we did. We didn't like it very much, so we dumped it. I think we wrote two. It was a great title. It was perfect for the show, but it didn't work musically, so we didn't use it.
Fair enough. And how are things in France? As we've seen on the news, the Cannes Film Festival was held recently, but I'm not really sure if the French are very much into musicals other than Les Miserables.
We were toying with a version of Victor Victoria in Paris. There was a French leading lady, and we decided to pass on it because the ingredients didn't feel right. So these things always crop up, and it's fascinating to see them appear here and there around the world. The show that's been the most amazing for us, or for me and my writing partner Frank Wildhorn, is Jekyll and Hyde. Jekyll and Hyde is produced every year in South Korea, of all places, at Seoul, which is a massive city. And it's been going for 18 years or something. It's just extraordinary.
Indeed.
It's like our mini Phantom of the Opera, you know. it's in Japan and all sorts of places. Very nice.
Do you have any concept as to why it might appeal to the Asian market, more so than the English-speaking market?
There's always been talk of a London production, and I think they've finally got the right management and actor for it next year, which will be in the spring. And also, one very good thing is we've got a movie on Jekyll and Hyde. A brilliant writer called Alex Dinalaris has written a wonderful screenplay and incorporated a great new idea, which takes care of the Me Too group. So we'll see.
Yes, and it finally got a professional premiere in Australia, albeit only in a concert version, but at least we had Anthony Warlow play the dual roles as he had on the original concept album.
Yes, he's a wonderful singer. He did the original album in Australia. We were there. He's got a wonderful voice. I admire him enormously. He's a great singer.
And I guess many of your other projects are on hold, but it gives you a chance to sit back and do a bit of writing, even if nothing is being staged at the moment.
Well, I've got two shows opening in the new year. We decided to wait till 2022. I've got Sherlock Holmes opening in, it'll open first, I think probably March. And then I've got my show Sammy, which is about Guess Who.
Mm-hmm.
that opens, I reckon, in the spring. So there'll be two back-to-back there. And got a wonderful guy to play Sammy, Giles Torreira, who won the Olivier Award for Hamilton last year.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a wonderful performer and looks amazingly like Sammy. When he does the makeup, it's quite amazing. You really think you're looking at Sam. And that will be very interesting.
Indeed, yes.
It deals with the darker side of Sam's life, you know, all the problems he had growing up in a difficult world.
Mm-hmm.
So that I think will be interesting. And we've incorporated a lot of the songs that he made famous. So I've got about 8 songs in the show that Newley and I wrote, which Sammy recorded when time was.
Mm-hmm.
And about 16 new songs, about 24 songs in the show, quite a lot for a musical.
Indeed, yes. And I guess that would be a hybrid form of what they call the jukebox musical, with the pre-established numbers and also the original score that you've written to tell the story, the book numbers, so to speak.
Well, it's got a very strong dramatic line as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not all fun and games at all, Sammy. It's a very dark show in every sense.
Indeed. Yes, his marriage with a Swedish actress, Mai Britt, copped a lot of flack at the time, too. So,
well, that was the time when we met him. He just married Mai, and they were very happy in England because England didn't react to the black-white marriage, but they weren't quite so happy in America. And that lasted till the middle of the 60s,
mm-hmm.
and then it broke up. And I remember Sammy saying to me, "Wouldn't you know she had to marry Dr. White?"
quite ironic indeed. And do you foresee that might eventually be made into a film, perhaps, if the stage production goes
Sammy,
successfully?
Yep. Yes, actually, on a different level, there's talk going on. In fact, the producer we're having dinner with tomorrow night from Hollywood, a friend of ours, we're talking about a movie because suddenly Sammy is an important figure.
Mm-hmm.
He always was, but he's much more important now as they look at the black leading performers. You know, they made a film called Ray about Ray Charles.
Mm-hmm.
Jamie Foxx, about 12 years ago. And he grew up with Sammy in Seattle, and Quincy Jones was a part of that group. And Quincy was here in France with me for over a year, beginning Sammy.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted him to write the score. But in the end, he didn't, and it's a shame. So that's why I went back to what I had in other areas. But we got the sparks for the show from that meeting.
Mm-hmm. Oh, great. And I guess the various musical styles and the various eras that he lived through present an interesting challenge for the orchestration of the show, whether you orchestrate it to reflect that era that it was written in or a sort of general orchestration for the whole show.
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, you can't change the style of those songs. They will have to sound like Sammy sounded, and the orchestrations will have to work in the same way because they're 60 years old, 50 years old, 40 years old. You know, Sammy died 30 years ago,
mm-hmm.
so it's another era.
Indeed, yes. Well, every success with that particular show and, oh, the other one, Sunday Dallas, I think it was called, about your understudy who goes on when the actress goes out on the one night for two shows.
Oh, yes. So it was called Sunday Dallas,
uh-huh.
Where she auditions for three shows and gets the audition for the three shows. She wins all three parts. And then in the second half of the show, they're all off on the same night, the three leading ladies. So she has to do... There are three theatres on Broadway where the stage doors link up, and so it is physically possible. And the three shows are at those three theatres. And it's great. It's great fun, that one. I changed the title now. It's called The Big Hit Musical.
Oh, okay. Right. and hopefully the title will be very predictive too when it eventually hits the stage too.
Yeah.
Great. Well, every success with your future projects, Leslie, and hopefully the animated films won't take too much longer to reach the big screen as well.
No, we're doing an animated version of Scrooge for Netflix, which is going to be rather beautiful. And I'm doing two or three animated projects, and I love doing them. I'm doing another one based on the Nutcracker Suite, which I think will be rather lovely, because you get to sing those great Tchaikovsky melodies.
Yes, quite a task, but I guess after you'd tackled George Gershwin's orchestral scores, Tchaikovsky's...
Well, actually, funnily enough, this very morning, I got the lady that I want for it. She's agreed to do it. Mm-hmm. And so in the spring, that will happen. And there's some wonderful songs written into that piece, especially the American in Paris theme. You know, the main theme is a beautiful song. It's called Paris in the Spring. And I hope that will work. I think it will.
Mm-hmm. Is it going to be done as a recording project before a concert with the conditions
as
they are?
No, we're going to do it as a performed. It's American in Paris, Rhapsody in Blue, Concerto in F, and the Cuban Overture. It's four pieces, 2 hours long. So it's a concert with a choir, and I think it'll sound pretty good.
Indeed, and double piano, I think it was the last...
That's right. That's the plan. So I'll let you know in the spring when we do it, Rob.
Certainly, great. Well, it should be well worth looking forward to. It's been, what, 20-odd years in the making, or is it 30-odd years?
Oh, God. It started in the 90s. Uh-huh. The Gershwins wouldn't let me in. They didn't see that they would benefit from it, because by my lifetime plus 70 years, they would have been in copyright. Mm-hmm. Now they're not. And I think it was very foolish of them not to. I did one show on television at Clinton's second inauguration, and Aretha Franklin called me the next morning and said, I've got to do this. And I had to say, you can't. Mm. So that's the way it's gone so far. Anyway, it's free now, and we'll have it up next year, I hope.
Exactly, yes.
I've been talking to Zubin Mehta, who conducts the LA Philharmonic, and he wanted to try and do it. This year is the 100th anniversary of the Hollywood Bowl, and he thought it would work very well in there. But I think I'm going to have to wait a little longer. But we can do it in England, and I look forward to that.
Ah, that's great. Well, every success with the concert and your future theatrical projects, and I look forward to catching up with you in the future, and hopefully when the worldwide situation improves and theatres start reopening.
Bless you, Robert. Lovely to talk to you, and we'll talk in the near future, I'm sure.
Great. Thank you very much, Leslie. And all the best to you and Evie there in France. Great.
Thanks a lot. God bless. Bye-bye.
Bye for now.